Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, episode number 75. I feel like this is a little bit of a milestone episode on our way to 100. Welcome to spring. This is being recorded at the very beginning of May, but I think spring has only just sprung in a lot of places, at least in the US. So hopefully everyone's enjoying a sunny day. This is Jamie Russo. I own a co-working space in Palo Alto, California. I am the executive director of the Global Workspace Association and the host of the Everything Coworking Podcast. This episode has two sponsors. The first is the 2018 Flexible Office Conference, hosted by the Global Workspace Association and NAOP, the Association for Developers and Building Owners. Last year, we had an accidental partnership after the GWA conference was postponed due to a hurricane in Miami. We made such good lemonade out of that situation that we decided to do it again. So this year's event is September 12th through 14th in Austin, Texas. If you haven't been to Austin, amazing food, amazing music, great weather. The hotel is right by a running path and a special bridge where lots of bats live, which we'll have to talk about later. Early bird tickets just went on sale, so get yours now at www.flexofficeconference.com. I'll put that in the show notes, everythingcoworking.com/75. I can tell you that if you are looking to start or scale your flexible office business, this is a do not miss event. The networking, the forward-looking content, and access to building owners is unparalleled. There is not another event like this happening in the industry. More details to come, but if you want to save $100 on your ticket, the early bird tickets are only on sale through May 25th. So head over to flexofficeconference.com and grab yours today. And the second sponsor is me and the Coworking Startup School. It's my program designed to help you create a profitable, sustainable coworking business that you love to run. The next cohort kicks off with a one-day live virtual event on May 24th. We only have a couple of spots left, so if you've been considering the Startup School program, head over to www.coworkingstartupschool.com and I will send you more details. This program is a good fit for you if you're investing in your coworking space and want to avoid costly mistakes and the stress you get by trying to figure this out on your own. So you can get expert and peer support in a highly facilitated environment. We want to make sure you create the right space for you and your target market right from the beginning. And we want to make sure that you get the business model right so that you're set up for financial sustainability that matches your goals. So we will review your pro forma, help you with your product mix, design, sourcing furniture, working with vendors, getting your marketing systems down, hiring the right team, or helping you learn how to run the space yourself, getting you set up with the right tech and more. So if this sounds like a fit for you, head over to www.coworkingstartupschool.com and I will send you some more details. Okay, let's dive into today's topic. So this is kind of an unusual one, but I was really inspired by reading a book that I will mention in a second here. But I will tell you, I have several podcasts being recorded in the next couple of weeks with a variety of industry leaders and influencers with good stories and expertise to share. So you'll start hearing a little bit less of me in the next few episodes, and I'm really excited to share those. So, but today, still me. And I've mentioned before that I'm a tiny bit nerdy. I have an MBA from the University of Chicago, which is pretty nerdy. And one of my favorite classes in business school was managerial decision making, which Richard Thaler taught one of the sections. They had this whole bidding system, and you had to use all of your points to get his class. So I did not use all of my points. Plus, I think class was on a Friday, and I didn't like classes on Fridays. So I took it with the other professor, but Thaler won a Nobel Prize, partly for, you know, the work he does in this area, and he has his own book. But the whole concept is about the fact that humans do unexpected things, and that's partly, they teach it in business school, partly because that's why markets aren't perfect, because humans are weird, and there are lots of biases that we have that, and Michael Lewis is one of my other favorite authors. He wrote a book last December called The Undoing Project, and I love that book. So if you're also a little nerdy, I highly recommend it, or just like understanding how people think. And this is what got me to thinking I should do an episode on this when I was reading the book, because it helps when you understand how people think and what how they make decisions. You can make decisions about your business and things like pricing, etc., instead of make sort of guessing. Sometimes we operate out of fear of what people will do. So I like to use data to help me get over my fear-based decision-making. So I found a couple of insights in this book that I thought I would share. So first, the book is called Predictably Irrational: The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions by Dan Ariely. I will put that in the show notes so that you can grab it on Amazon if you're interested. And I was actually talking about some of these insights with my new manager, and I sent her a copy of the book. So the first concept is the concept of market norms versus social norms. So the concept of market versus social norms is that there are some things in life related to money that are based on market forces and some that are based on social norms, and we have to treat these things differently. So again, you're probably better off reading the book directly, but I'm going to play mailman and try to give you a sense of how this works. So the best example in the book was this idea about Thanksgiving dinner. So the example is your mother-in-law hosts Thanksgiving dinner. Your wife has made the pie. You're sitting at dinner with the family. Your mother-in-law feels quite lovely about how everything has turned out. She loves having the family all in one place. She's slaved all day, probably the day before, preparing. Some folks have brought a little something to share. It's dessert time. Everybody's complimenting the dinner. At this point, you cannot stand up and say, "Hey, Mary, dinner was amazing. Thank you for all the work you've put into it. What do you think would cover this? 300? 400? Right? She would probably fall over in her chair or never speak to you again, because that is just not what you do when someone invites you over for dinner. And the book talks about like how rationally things. So another example would be a friend invites you over for dinner. The nice thing to do, the appropriate thing to do, is to bring something, some flowers, a bottle of wine. So you bring a $50 bottle of Bordeaux. And the book talks about the idea that rationally, your host might get more utility out of $50 in cash versus $50 in Bordeaux, but that's not a market norm. That's a social norm. So you can't give your host cash instead of wine. You have to bring wine. That's the appropriate thing to do, and everybody feels like that's the right exchange. You can't pay your friend for hosting you for dinner, right? Maybe you would in college when everybody's completely broke, but as adults, we don't do that. So, and then another example they gave that I thought was really good was around changing a tire. So if you're on the side of the road, somebody pulls over and offers to help you change a tire. They're doing this because they're a good Samaritan and somehow they feel like this is good karma because no one wants to change a tire, right? So the idea is they'll stop and they will just offer to help you. But if you asked someone to help you change a tire and you opened your wallet and said, "Well, all I have is like $3, does that work?" No one wants to change your tire for $3, but they will do it for free because it's a social norm. So like in the market norm example, it would cost a lot of money to get your tire changed, but someone will do it for free as a social norm as long as you don't introduce money. So again, the book probably explains this a little better, but what I thought was interesting, they also give an example of employees and the idea of, so again, another example is you have an employee who's done a really good job, working really hard. You want to reward her and sort of encourage her to continue to be amazing. So you think maybe I will give her a bonus of $1,000. So the book says, think twice about using sort of a market reward versus a social reward. So the book suggests you might gift that employee a trip, a long weekend somewhere that's about equivalent to $1,000. Yes, you could sit there and say, maybe the employee would rather have the cash and decide how to use it. Maybe the employee wants a new iPad, you know, or they want a weekend that's closer to home and they'd save some money and pay off a bill. So like rationally, you might be tempted to give the employee a choice or give them cash. But if you want the most out of it socially, you would gift them something. So gift them a trip to the Bahamas was the example in the book. Probably costs more than $1,000 to send somebody to the Bahamas. But the book suggests that as a social norm, that's better for everyone. The person is not putting a dollar amount, so the employee is not putting a dollar amount on what you've offered them. Because in their mind, they may think they're doing a heck of a lot more extra work than what $1,000 accounts for. So gifting them and sending them away for the weekend and maybe giving them an extra day off will send them away, give them a mental break, help them feel really appreciated, and it'll just be a different value exchange than if you're trying to cover, you know, the extra work that they're doing, which probably you don't have the budget to do. So I thought of that in terms of co-working. When we think, we talk a lot in groups that I'm in, you know, folks who are scaling and hiring, like how do you incent employees and how do you reward them? And should you be giving them a percent of profit? Should you be rewarding them for tours closed? And some folks absolutely do this and it works. And I'm certainly a capitalist at heart. And who doesn't like, you know, cash rewards? But it made me think about it because in our industry, the transactions are not high in value. So the dollar amounts that we're rewarding are relatively small. You know, it's not like they're brokers and they're closing a, you know, 50,000 square foot space and 3% of that is a big dollar amount. When we're talking about selling an office, you know, it's a small dollar amount. So how do you motivate someone and thank them for that work? Gifting them might be better than offering them a cash payment. And the other struggle I've had with that, which I think I've mentioned before, is that when you hire people that are really good, inherently they want to do well and they want to hit their metrics. And so paying them for hitting their metrics, if they're not in a sales-only role, you may sort of violate that social norm of just appreciating that they're doing their best and doing a great job. Now, if somebody is in a strictly sales role, those personalities may be motivated differently, and it may make sense to give them targets and reward them financially for those targets. So I'm thinking more of a community manager who has a lot of hats, and one of them is sales. So just a little food for thought, gifting might be a better reward or more time off or something sort of soft versus a monetary reward. Oh, and the other place this plays in is member referrals. And this just came up in our own space. My manager slacked me today and said, oh, we have a member who's brought two people in for referrals. Should we give him a referral reward? And I said, well, have we been promoting a referral program? And she said, no. And I said, well, then I think the right thing to do would be to gift him if they join and write him a nice thank you note and maybe give him a gift card to his favorite lunch place or something like that, rather than giving him, you know, $200 per referral. And we've certainly talked about doing a monetary referral program, which is why this book really made me think. And I thought, you know, there's no right way to do things, but I like things that give us food for thought. And this book is based all on data, like experiments that they've done that yield these results. And so oftentimes as business owners, frankly, we are just guessing. And we are also doing what we see other operators do. So other operators have monetary referral programs, we do the same thing. And I think the referral program kind of struck me especially relevant to our industry because it's so community-based. And I actually had a conversation with one of my members yesterday, and she was talking about how much she loves the community and how it's really grown over time. And sort of she feels proud of the friendships that she's made outside of, you know, her home and at work. And I thought, you know, it might be violating a social norm to pay people to bring others into the community. Because again, you're sort of putting a monetary value on something that people value as a social piece of their life. And if not meaning that people don't get monetary value and that there's not a monetary ROI often out of joining a co-working space, but that social connection and inviting their friends to be a part of that, monetarily rewarding that may not be the right thing to do. So think about that. The book also talks about the high price of ownership, that people really, really value what they have. And the example in the book, and the book makes it a really long story, so I'm going to make it really short, is Duke basketball. So apparently, in order to get Duke basketball tickets, season tickets, I think, or maybe it was a playoff ticket, you have to, I can't remember the exact details, but it involves camping outside for a week at a time. And it gets complicated. You have to have people from your tent check in every so often. So somebody has to be in the tent at all times. You can't just put up the tent and then go to class and never go to, you know, not be there and sleep at home or whatever. So you're super, super committed to this process, and you have to be sort of an avid fan to do this and commit to this in order to get tickets to, I think it was the playoffs, the example in the book. So long story short, after that process was over, the researchers, Dan and his team, got the phone numbers of people who had won tickets and randomly called people who had not gotten tickets. And again, long story short, they asked the people who did not get the tickets but had waited in line what they'd be willing to pay for tickets. And then they asked the folks who had won the tickets what they would be willing to sell them for. And the difference was enormous. Like, the people who had waited in line but had not gotten tickets were willing to pay like $175 to get the tickets. The people who had gotten them wanted to sell them for thousands of dollars. So there's no overlap there. And the, you know, so the takeaway is, once you own something, you value it greatly. And this probably also plays into why we all have closets full of clothes that we're not willing to give up. The woman who wrote The Joy and Art of Tidying Up talks about loss aversion and the fact that when we own something, we're really unwilling to give it up, even if we never wear it. But the insight for co-working is this: if you have sold a member into a membership, they're not likely to downgrade or want to give that up. So a couple of things. We have a lot of people, you know, will ask us to put their memberships on hold if they're gone for a month. And our position is generally we don't do that if they're gone for a short period of time. If they're going to be gone for a long time, they need to give up their membership and then come back. And people usually don't mind doing this because, well, the gym's not going to let you out for a month or two. But also, I think that sense of ownership. But the other insight is something that we talk about a lot lately, and we've been talking about this in our flight groups, is around pricing and membership options. And, you know, if you offer a full-time membership option, but then you introduce a part-time membership option to test, how does that work in my market? You know, can I sell enough of those to make it worth it? Is there more demand for that than full-time options? And I tend to caution against the part-time option because you have to sell so many more of them, and you have to, you know, your top of your sales funnel has to be really strong in order to get enough people through the door to sell those. On the other hand, if you can sell them in quantity, then that makes up for it. I think the insight here is people worry about, okay, if I introduce this after I already have a lot of full-time members, will they downgrade? And I'd be in big trouble if people downgraded. So the insight here in the examples they gave in the research is that people do not like to downgrade once they have something. So one of the examples they gave was Starbucks coffee, which probably most of us can relate to. So anybody who'd been drinking coffee before Starbucks was invented would drink like a pretty average cup of coffee. Instant coffee used to be, you know, a thing. So not many people drink that anymore, right? So people went from drinking cheap coffee at home to paying for cups of coffee, and then maybe even paying for lattes and macchiatos. And those things are $4 a pop at least. So, but then once you're used to that habit, it's hard to downgrade. Now you think like that's just part of your, you know, what you're entitled to every day. And so your budget sort of for coffee, you know, quadruples in many cases. But you're just human nature that we're not going to downgrade that because that's what we've gotten used to. And we think that's, you know, sort of what we deserve. And so people who have full-time memberships will sort of value that ownership and not be likely to downgrade, is my theory. So we'll have to test it. But that was kind of my insight there. The other thing that they bring up in the book is trials, and how if you can trial somebody to a higher package, they also tend to sort of have that ownership, that value around ownership, and not want to give that up. So a thought I had on that was, what about running trials for people who have full-time co-working memberships, trial them on a dedicated desk for a reduced amount of money for a month, and try to sort of instill that sense of ownership on the dedicated desk and see if they stick with that versus going back to their co-working, full-time co-working membership. I think a lot of us are always thinking like, well, isn't it a natural, you know, behavior that people would come in and try co-working and then upgrade to a dedicated desk and then eventually an office? And we don't see that happen often, but I think the trial of the dedicated desk could be pretty interesting to kind of instill that sense of ownership and sort of do the Starbucks model where we start them with the cup of coffee, but move them up to the cappuccino or the frappuccino. Another one that I thought was really interesting is that setting expectations can impact experiences. So they had a lot of examples in the book around how if you set somebody up to expect a certain thing, then that's what they was sort of delivered, even if they delivered something else. So they had some examples of putting vinegar in beer and people thinking it tasted amazing. And then taste tests. They did some pretty elaborate taste tests between Coke and Pepsi and telling people it was one versus the other. But the conclusion is that you can impact people's experiences by setting expectations. So their experience will be better than otherwise if you sort of hype up whatever it is that they're about to experience beforehand. So one example was that in the book was you can invite people to, when you invite people to a movie, you can increase their enjoyment by mentioning that it got great reviews. So, and that's what marketing is about, the book points out, you know, providing information that will heighten someone's anticipated and real pleasure. So a couple of insights I had from that were including testimonials on your website, like actual members, and make those pretty accessible, like maybe on the homepage right under your packages, talking about how great the space is and, you know, the relationships that they've built and the ROI in their business. And then one other minor, really minor example was, you know, we're always trying to figure out, you know, sort of coffee and what coffee to serve. And our coffee has gotten really expensive. So we've been trying to decide, you know, can we serve a different coffee? Not a bad coffee, but a different coffee. But the book gives a specific coffee related example. And essentially people like the coffee a lot more if you have set out fancy containers for the condiments. So like the sugar and the, you know, cocoa powder and things like that. So if you make a fancy display out of the coffee arrangement, people actually like the coffee more just by seeing it there, not even using it. And actually the sugar is a bad example. They put out in the experiment, they put out really weird condiments that no one actually used. But the containers for those condiments were super attractive. And so they didn't actually use them. They only looked at them. And even just looking at them improved the ratings of the coffee versus when they put the condiments in unfancy styrofoam containers. So I thought that was sort of interesting. Aesthetics can actually have an impact on how people experience things like coffee. So something to think of. Okay, so this is kind of a short one. Those were my few insights, but I highly recommend the book. Again, the book is called Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions by Dan Ariely. And I will include the link in the show notes. And I'm going to sign off for this week, but look forward to an exciting interview next week.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.